I love musical theater. I really do. I can't sing or dance worth a darn. Any of you who know me well know that. But boy, do I love watching people who can. There is something about setting a story to music that just makes me experience it in a whole other way. I remember I got to see my first professional musical theater production about 30 years ago when Simon and I were in London. It was Les Miserables, and it was a great one to start with. It was phenomenal. I loved it. I loved the music. I loved the performances. The sets were incredible, and watching how they changed them, oh, was amazing. But most of all, I actually fell in love with Victor Hugo's classic story. It's an amazing story. And I loved it so much that Simon and I have actually spent the last 30 years seeing it in other places, in other performances, whenever we can, including the film version that came out in 2012. Now, I confess to you, before we went to the movie, I was a bit skeptical. I just wasn't sure if the magic of live performance would translate to the big screen. And some of those actors were not actors I knew to be musical theater performers. But I have to tell you that, for the most part, their performances were pretty good. Some of them remarkably good. And that story, the magic transferred. It did not disappoint. To the point that I will never forget something that happened at the end of the movie. As the credits were rolling, the lights came up and people began to stand up, as you do, but they didn't leave. They just kind of stood around, lingering. It was like we were in a moment, and it was a moment we didn't want to let go of. It's actually something I've seen happen here on occasion after one of those worship services. We can linger for a bit. We don't want it to end. But I've never experienced that in a movie theater before or since. That story had left them with something that they wanted to hold on to. Many of you are probably familiar with the story of Les Mis. It takes place in dark and difficult days, in the dark days of the 19th century in France, a time of political and civil unrest that was fueled in part by grinding poverty. The main character, Jean Valjean, has been in prison for 19 years for stealing a loaf of bread to try to feed a nephew of his who was starving. As the story begins, Valjean has been released on parole. But times are desperate, and Valjean has nothing. A kind bishop takes him into his home and gives him shelter for the night. And during the night, Valjean does what he's learned to do to survive. His desperation gets the better of him, and he steals some silver from the bishop and then escapes, breaking his parole. Well, he's caught by the police, and they haul him back to the bishop so the bishop can testify to his guilt. But the kind cleric doesn't have Valjean arrested. Instead, he tells the police that he actually gave Valjean the silver. And then he goes to the mantelpiece and collects more and puts it in Valjean's bag and says, "Would you leave the rest behind? You forgot this. Take this too." It's really an amazing moment. And the police in that moment are skeptical. They think they know he's actually stolen this, but without the bishop's testimony, what can they do? So they let Valjean go free. And that whole experience, it actually sets up the whole rest of the story. The grace that was shown him by the bishop has such an impact on Valjean that he vows to use his freedom for good. He assumes a new identity, and he dedicates the rest of his life to helping people who are in need. Well, there's another character in that story. His name is Javert, and he is a determined and diligent policeman who spends his entire life hunting Valjean, the prisoner who escaped on parole. He never stops looking for him. I've always thought that in some way, maybe Javert, this stern policeman who is so proud of his role and his place in society. And Valjean, this thief who's been given a second chance, I thought that they might themselves be expansions of the two characters that we've just heard about in the parable Phil read for us, the Pharisee and the tax collector. I kind of wonder if maybe Hugo had that parable in his mind as he was creating those characters. Well, as you will remember if you were with us last Sunday, we are in a section of Luke's gospel in this season that is rich with Jesus' teachings, particularly his teachings in parables. Last week we got to hear a parable that Jesus told to some people who were at risk of losing hope. Well, this week, as Luke explained at the very beginning of the reading, we've come to one that he told to some people who were confident in their own righteousness, to the point that they were looking down on everyone else. It's a simple story of two men, a Pharisee who diligently keeps God's laws, and a tax collector who makes his living by collecting taxes from his fellow countrymen and then skimming off the top to line his own pockets. Both of the men come to the temple to pray, and their prayers reveal much. The Pharisee spends his time thanking God for how upstanding and wonderful he is, especially in comparison to some pretty, well, rotten people. He reminds God of his exemplary piety and his faithfulness in prayer and fasting and tithing, that he regularly practices each of those things with great commitment. The Pharisee feels pretty good about himself and about all that he's doing. Well, the tax collector, he's actually someone who likely would have been hated by most people, and he had a different approach to God. For starters, he barely gets in the door. He stays way at the back in the temple. It's as if he has this sense that he needs to keep his distance from God. And his prayer, it's a whole different thing. He's really the picture of penitence. He beats his breasts, prays simply for God to have mercy on him, acknowledging before God and anyone there who cared to listen that he knows he is a sinner unworthy of God's attention, let alone love. This fellow really has this air of desperation about him. He needs God's mercy, and he knows it, and he clearly knows that he has no right to it. He's this stark contrast to the self-righteous Pharisee. Well, Jesus' story is really short and to the point. He describes the two prayers, and then he shocks his listeners by pronouncing that it will actually be the sinful tax collector who's justified before God, not the pious Pharisee with all of his religious busyness. And Jesus warns that all those who exalt themselves, like the Pharisee was doing, they'll be humbled. But he also promises that all those who humble themselves will be exalted. The Pharisee seems to think that he's got things covered through his own diligent religious efforts. Well, Jesus warns that pride like that will lead to a fall. But humility, like the tax collector had shown, now that's what really gets God's attention. Well, here's the thing about parables like this. Parables where there are often two and sometimes three characters, and they're kind of set in contrast to each other. When I hear these, I find myself trying to figure out which character I identify with. Am I the prodigal son, or am I the elder brother? Am I the servant with five talents, or the one with one? I don't think I'm the one with 10. Am I Mary, or am I Martha? That one's not a parable, but it brings out the same response in me. You know what I mean? Maybe you have the same inclination. We tend to gravitate towards one or the other of them. I suspect that most people who first heard Jesus tell these parables in person probably did the same thing as they were listening. In fact, I think he hoped that they did that.
Because it's in that experience that we actually discover the power in the message.
Well, in this parable, we get tripped up pretty quickly in this because it's hard to want to see yourself in either of those fellows. Our choice is a self-righteous, legalistic Pharisee or a corrupt yet humble tax collector. There's no real obvious good guy or bad guy here for us to pick from. Each one comes to God in prayer with his flaws clearly on display. And as is so often the case, each one has something to teach us. In the tax collector's experience, we can see that sinful as he clearly is, his humble acknowledgement of his sin and his desperate need for God's grace and mercy, they're compelling to God. He clearly understands that he needs God's grace, and he knows he has no claim to it. And God virtually says, "Yes, my son, my love and my grace are yours." The tax collector has no illusions that he's a good person living a good life, or that the grace he receives from God is in any way his doing. He actually reminds us that that's true for all of us. No matter who you are or what you've done, grace is just that. Pure gift. It's not our doing in any way, shape, or form. So if you find yourself leaning a little more towards the tax collector this morning, Jesus has great news for you. You can be assured that your prayers have been heard and answered, that God has already granted you the grace you seek. Well, that's the tax collector. But some of us, if we're going to be honest, we're sitting in church on Sunday morning, we may actually identify a little more with the Pharisee. It's hard to admit. But what's our lesson from him? Well, let's start by giving him his due. In his own way, I suspect this fellow was very devoted to God. Maybe that's why he spent so much time fasting and praying and tithing. His intentions were probably very good. But somewhere along the line, something got twisted. Somehow he had slipped into thinking that those good practices were assuring him of God's love and God's favor, that they were earning him a special place in God's heart, a place that he thought was far above others. He'd grown proud of his piety. And it sounds obviously so wrong when I say it like that, doesn't it? But the truth is that we can all slip into this little twist. We find ourselves doing these very good things that are part of our faith, but the twist happens and we're doing them for the wrong reasons. Deep down, we begin to believe that maybe they are earning us our place in God's heart. And there's so much that's wrong with that thinking, the most dangerous of which is that it means that we think that it's our efforts that are keeping us right with God. That's the lie underneath that belief, that God isn't saving us, we are saving ourselves. We're doing it through all of our religious activity. And so we find that we don't really need God because we can do it ourselves. That's exactly what the Pharisee was thanking God for in his prayer, that he was doing such a good job of saving himself. And other people were not. And that's exactly why Jesus sadly points out that he wasn't going to get to go home justified. It's not that God's punishing him because he'd become proud. It's that his pride was actually getting in the way. It had lulled him into forgetting our most basic Christian truth, that we can't save ourselves. We are saved purely by the grace and mercy of God, given freely to us because, as crazy as it sounds, just because he loves us. Well, the honest truth is that we can all get caught in this. I know I do.
It's actually one of the strange dangers in incorporating intentional spiritual practices like prayer and fasting and service and worship and all the other things we do into our lives. But the solution is not to abandon those practices, because they're also the very way that God has given us to stay connected and in close relationship with Him. The solution is actually to do those things, but to do them with the right mind, the right heart, remembering that they are not the way we earn God's love. They're our loving response to the love God is already showing us. The image in my mind is it's like God's given us a hug. He's already thrown His arms around us. And when we practice these things that help us to stay connected, it's simply like we're throwing our arms back around Him. We're returning the hug. That's why the Apostle John wrote, "We love because God first loved us." And it's why, as we heard in the Assurance of Grace this morning, Paul reminds us that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. God's love has always come first. You can't possibly beat God to the punch in love. It's impossible. It will always come first. And when we remember that regularly, then humility actually comes quite naturally. And there's no danger of us slipping into that trap of pride that the Pharisees have fallen into. We love simply and entirely because we know that God has shown His love to us so generously. Which actually has me thinking again about that story of Les Mis and about how that night in the theater nobody wanted to leave. I'm hoping it was because they saw something in that story, something that seemed true and right and good and beautiful. In the end, Jean Valjean's story is one of grace. And it shows the power that grace can have in our lives and in our world. Not only did the bishop keep Valjean from being arrested, he gave him even more silver to go and make a new start with. It's kind of ridiculous. You can probably think of some modern parallels. That generosity, that incredible abundance of grace, it changed Valjean. And he determined then and there to spend the rest of his life doing whatever he could to share it with others. That's the thing about grace. It doesn't just come to us. It's meant to flow through us. We know full well that all that we have is pure gift. And so in humility, we're clear. We haven't earned this. So anything we do, we're doing simply as a loving response to that incredible gift, grace. And so quite naturally, we find it easier to be gracious and to be kind with others. We begin to reflect this grace we've received. That's why pride is so dangerous, and it's why Jesus wanted to warn these people about it. Because pride hurts us, and it hurts others. Remember that Luke told us that Jesus told this parable to some people who had grown proud, and in their pride, they were looking down on everyone else. Because that's what pride does. It hardens our hearts to others, and it makes us judgmental. It acts like this great big stopper that prevents us from sharing the grace God is trying to pour in and through our lives with others. But humility, the humility that Jesus shows us in the tax collector, it changes things. We recognize that the abundance of grace we have in our own lives, and we know full well it's pure gift. And so, like Jean Valjean, we find ourselves freely and even naturally sharing that grace with others. If pride can keep us stuck in unloving judgment, then it's humility that actually frees us. Frees us to be the people we've been created to be. People who know they've received great grace. people who share great grace with others. Amen.